Live from Utrecht, this is Bitcoin
Explained.
Hey, Sjors.
Hello.
So this was kind of funny. We always have, you know, our conversation before we do the actual podcast one day in advance. And then you ask me, do you have any topics? And I ask you, do you have any topics? And this time we both had a topic in mind, but we both had a different topic in mind, except it turned out it was sort of the same topic after all.
Exactly.
We just approached it from like opposite directions, and then we realized that we were, you know, talking about the same thing. So we're going to talk about stamps and an invalid block that was found.
On April Fool's Day.
The block was mined on April Fool's Day?
Yes.
Right. But first, Sjors, you want to read some boostergrams, I think? Is that what it's called?
That's right.
Sjors stacks sets.
Hooray. Okay, I've got one from Eric99 for 50,000 sats. And he says, stay humble, stack sats.
There you go. Okay, where do we start with this? So we did an episode on inscriptions 2-3 episodes ago, something like that. And in a way, I guess stamps are a new way of doing inscriptions, but they're really an old way, or...
Yeah, they're really an old and very inefficient way to do
they're
inscriptions.
They're kind of a rediscovered older... when we discussed inscriptions, the point was that people were always putting stuff on the blockchain, and then Bitcoin developers figured out better ways of doing it, and now stamps is kind of going back to the bad ways of doing it.
Yeah, because they realized that that putting things on the blockchain is a van Weerdem good, as you would call it.
that's a reference. That's a deep reference to the Bitcoin Show or Dutch podcast.
Yes, and I forgot what the actual word was.
Fabelen good.
Yeah, Babylon good or something. Anyway, it means something that, because it's expensive, it's actually more popular. So you'd think you don't want to put too much stuff on the blockchain because that is, you know, inefficient. But it turns out that because it's so expensive to put stuff on the blockchain, it actually suddenly became popular with inscriptions. And so the folks from Counterparty said that they had an old method to put data on the blockchain even more inefficiently than with ordinals. So that's sort of what you were seeing. And then what I was seeing was that there was an invalid block, and I started looking at why that block was invalid. And that actually ties into what we discussed last episode. Because in our last episode, we talked about multisig. And one of the things we discussed as part of multisig was this weird thing called the SigOps counter. And this is a, you know, so a block can have 4 megabyte or like whatever, 4 megabyte worth of stuff in it, and there's this counter for how much, so SegWit data counts as less than regular data, and there is this, and that's how you get a fee market, which is a fairly straightforward way to calculate. But then the problem is there's another counter for things that involve signature checking called the SigOps counter. And it turns out that the reason this block failed, or at least the message I saw when the block failed, was max SigOps exceeded.
Yeah, we'll get to that, yeah. I think, later. But yeah, you're right. So we discussed that in the previous episode. And then I think maybe the episode before that was inscriptions. So this episode is sort of combining insights from the previous two episodes.
Yes.
Is there? Okay.
And the other observation I guess we did was a very happy Mike in space on Twitter. Though not because of the failed block, but very much around the same time.
I was just going to ask, so who's Mike in Space? Because Mike in Space introduced this stamps protocol, right?
Yeah, well, Mike in Space is a famous movie maker. He made this this series, Bitcoin Car Talk.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also involved with the Counterparty protocol.
I think there's probably a lot of newer Bitcoiners that may not know Mike in Space. He was sort of a comic relief type of figure on Bitcoin Twitter.
Yeah,
sort of during the block size war kind of era, I would say.
Yeah, so the Bitcoin Car Talk series, the very short videos he made were quite funny. I don't know if they're still on YouTube, but they would involve him sitting in a car and calling somebody else who might be sitting in another car and talking about something technical but in a funny way, and then either the car would explode or somebody would be in the trunk.
Yeah, there were like spoof interviews with Bitcoin developers and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So now he somehow introduced a new protocol. I guess my question to you, or is this serious? Because we know him as a comedian, basically, right?
Is it
supposed to be serious? How are we supposed to look at this or think about this?
This is always difficult to know, right? Because Counterparty was partly a joke, especially with the Rare Peppy that was being traded. But Rare Peppy was essentially there before even CryptoKitties, one of the first NFTs. And though that trading was kind of a joke, but also involved money, and it had its own token, so, you know, that was partly a joke, but it was also not a joke, and some people made money, some people lost money. So you never know with these things.
I mean, did I discuss this
before? The blockchain doesn't care whether it's a joke or not.
Yeah, I don't remember if I discussed this on the podcast before, but what's the guy's name who was behind the whole Rare Peppa thing and who was promoting it? I should know his name. I know his name.
Well, John Seth is one of them, but he was not behind it, but he was promoting it. But he was jokingly promoting it as part of Bitcoin Uncensored.
Well, that's the point. Man, his name is slipping my mind right now. Anyways.
John Carvalho?
No. Yeah, his name is escaping me. But yeah, no, I always took it as a joke, and I thought it was like a hilarious joke. I thought it was... He did this interview, there was this famous interview, Shores. Maybe we're going off the rails now with these sort of half-baked memories. He did this famous interview at the time about Rare Peppas and sort of defending it, and it was really hilarious. And then I ran into him pretty recently, like a year ago, and I commented on how funny that interview was. And the reason it was so funny, because he kept a straight face the whole time. And now I ran into him and I told him that. And turns out that no, he wasn't actually, like, his straight face was a genuine straight face. He was actually being serious about the whole NFT thing. And he actually believed in it. Well, for me, it was... Anyways, a lot of people, including myself, thought it was like taking the piss out of the concept. But no, he actually believed in it. And I guess a lot of people believe in the whole NFT thing.
Well, but it ran into problems because all these transactions were on-chain, and especially early on, fees started going up in the Bitcoin network. Fee estimation was very bad. So I think the wallet software that Counterparty was using was just a modified Bitcoin Core client, which did not have very good fee estimation. And so each of these transactions became extremely expensive, and I think they even thought about moving the whole protocol off to one of the forks or some other blockchain. So we hadn't really heard from it in a while, but once the Ordinals inscription stuff started coming about, I think they kind of made a comeback. And so this Stamps protocol is just one example of how you can use Counterparty. And I think the idea there is you put very small images on the blockchain, so 64 by 64 pixels, and then you trade them.
Okay, so let's talk about it more in detail, more specifically. So last time in our inscriptions episode, we discussed, or ordinals inscriptions episode, we discussed inscriptions, and that's a way of putting data in the blockchain. And then there were sort of the ordinals, and that lets you supposedly trade ownership, or whatever you want to call it. It allows people to pretend that they own whatever data is on the blockchain.
Yes.
Now, stamps are kind of the equivalent of inscriptions. And there is probably also an equivalent of ordinals, which is traded on Counterparty. But like our inscriptions episode, we're not really going to talk about that. We're just going to talk about how you upload data into the blockchain, right?
Yeah, I would say that Counterparty has a different way of changing, telling the blockchain, well, not telling the blockchain, telling people who owns which asset by making transactions on the blockchain that would say, okay, this asset has moved from A to B. And the way Counterparty does it, I don't know exactly, but I do know it's different from the way ordinals do it.
Right.
And it doesn't really matter. I mean, the blockchain doesn't care what's happening, but from the outside, you do see, I think in the case of Counterparty, you usually see a bunch of up return transactions. And if you run the right software, that software will know what those up return transactions mean, and it will know who owns which Counterparty asset, and they can show you pictures.
Stamps are like inscriptions,
mm-hmm.
Right? And that's okay. So is a stamp, because you've mentioned Counterparty a couple of times, is stamps just using Counterparty in the same way that Rare Peppas was using Counterparty?
That is my understanding. I think the only difference is that you put the word stamp in front of it, like when you're making the asset, and I think you also should use 64 by 64 pixels. So it's kind of a convention on top of Counterparty. That's my understanding. But it uses all the same rails.
Okay, so it's not actually that new.
No, I think the new thing is this convention around it that makes it a little bit more similar to how inscriptions work. But I don't think the technology itself is new.
Okay, I think there's one new thing about it, and we'll get to that.
Okay.
But let's just first say can you explain how it works?
Yeah, so basically when you create the asset or whatever it is, you have to put the data on the blockchain. That's hip nowadays.
Yeah, so how do you put the data on the blockchain?
So they do that using Counterparty, and Counterparty has different ways of doing it depending on how big the thing is that you want to put in the blockchain. So basically, if it's less than 80 bytes, it'll put up return on the blockchain. But if it's more than 80 byte, it's going to fall back to an older mechanism, which uses fake multi-signature addresses, fake raw or bare multisig. And we described what bare multisig is last week. But basically, it looks to the blockchain looks like a one out of three multisig. And the idea is that so when you create a multisig address, you have to specify which public keys can spend it. And it turns out that one of those public keys is real. So actually the owner.
Well, that's new in stamps, right? Or not?
Yes, but it's not new in Counterparty.
Oh, okay. So then there's literally nothing new about stamps.
Pretty much.
Oh, it's just a troll then. I didn't realize it was literally just a troll. Now it sounds like it's just a troll.
Well, it sounds like there's a little bit of extra convention around it, but it's basically repurposing what already existed.
Okay. All right. Well, I didn't know that.
So one of the three public keys is real. So you can actually spend it. And then two of the three are fake. And that means that you get 32 bytes per signature. So you get 64 bytes for each of these multisig outputs that you can put real data in. Now, if you have an image that's, say, I don't know, 200 bytes, you're going to need four of these outputs. So you make a transaction that has coins going in, and it has, on the output side, it will have four, basically, UTXOs, each of which have two real public keys one real public key and two fake public keys, and that's how you're stuffing the data in. So you can put as much data as you want on the blockchain this way.
Okay, but we've discussed some of these things before, but let me break it down because you've mentioned a couple different things now. So Counterparty as a protocol, as a layer 2 protocol for Bitcoin, has several different ways of including data on the blockchain. Now, the first way that people, even before Counterparty, I guess, the first way that people were putting data on the blockchain, I don't know if it was the first actually, but the first of my that I know of was this bare multisig trick, essentially, that you're mentioning. Although probably at first there was not even a single key that was valid, right? I think.
Either way. I don't remember. We did an episode called The Up-Return Wars a long time ago where I think we explained all the mechanisms. It's possible that they used up-return first, then there was a limit in up-return, then they thought, okay, then we'll just use multisig. But it's also possible that they started with the multisig from the beginning.
Right. Well, it's kind of that episode I was sort of rehashing here. So
three be fake. So you would have a 3 of 3 multisig, and all three public keys would be fake.
Right. So there was the bare multisig way of doing it. And then at some point, Bitcoin developer said, all right, use up-return, because that way you can prune the data more easily. So Counterparty actually does use the up-return, but then if the data doesn't fit within the up-return, they fall back to the bare multisig, which is sort of older than using up-return.
Yes.
And that way you can still include as much data as you want.
Yes.
Okay. So stamps is data, for example, pictures most obviously. And stamps, because they're too big for up-return, stamps use Counterparty, they use the Counterparty protocol, but because they're too big for the up-return option, they use the bare multisig option.
Yes.
Okay. And the way they're doing it specifically is they're using, I think you said, 1 out of 3 multisig?
That's right.
Where two of the addresses, public keys, are actually just fake data. Well, they are the data you're uploading. There are no actual private keys, so you can't spend from these two public keys. But then the remaining public key is actually real, and there's a private key, so that would allow you to spend.
Yeah, so that's the biggest difference, I guess. It's actually possible to remove these things from the UTXO set. So as we've discussed before, the UTXO set is a set of who owns which coin, And these nodes like to keep this in RAM. They can't because it's too big, but they prefer to keep as much as possible in RAM because that makes it quicker to figure out when a new block comes in, whether a coin that's being mentioned in the block actually exists or not. So to very quickly look it up and to look up what the script. Now, when the blockchain has no idea whether a public key is fake or not. So when it has a UTXO that mentions three public keys, it'll simply assume that those three public keys are real. And so it's going to keep it in memory just like it would keep anything else in memory. So by using a mechanism like this, you're using up other people's RAM, and essentially. You can spend it, you can still, you know, remove it from people's RAM if you want to.
Yo, what is going on, guys? We are proud to have Voltage as a sponsor of this episode. How many of you developers out there have wanted a streamlined infrastructure provider for your particular project? Well, I'll tell you what, Voltage is the Bitcoin infrastructure provider you have been looking for that makes building on Bitcoin quick and easy, whether it's Bitcoin nodes, Lightning nodes, BTC Pay, and so much more. But don't take it from me. Just ask the guys over at Amboss, Sphinx, Podcast Index, and Thunder Games, and so many others that you guys already know and love. Their enterprise-grade products make it fast and easy to build, deploy, and scale your next project. So make it easy on yourself. Even normie plebs can use the dashboard or API. Don't wait before the next block confirmation. Let your team focus on building great products and let Voltage handle all the rest. Voltage is your go-to zero management Bitcoin infrastructure solution.
I was first going to ask, so this is why Bitcoin developers essentially don't like this method, right?
Yes.
Like you.
Yes, because the difference with OpReturn is that OpReturn, because it is provably unspendable, because the way the script works is when it sees OpReturn, it says this script is invalid. That's what it means. And therefore, because the node knows can prove that the script is invalid, it can forget about it because it knows it can never be spent. So it does not have to hold on to it. And so anything that comes after the OpReturn then is just data you can put in the blockchain, and it'll use disk space. If you're storing the whole blockchain, you have to download it, but you don't have to keep it in memory to see who owns this particular output.
Right. So whatever is stored in the UTXO set, I guess one, can also be pruned, and two, practically speaking, most Bitcoin nodes would keep that in RAM.
If they have the space to keep it in RAM, yeah, and if you want your nodes to be fast.
So what happens if everyone would start using stamps? What's the problem that I will encounter on my node, for example?
Well, then you will see the size of the UTXO set grow. And it's been remarkably stable, so it seems to have reached, when you're keeping it in memory on your node, it might peak at about 12 or 13 gigabytes. And then, I think that was a few years ago, and then it goes down a bit, but yeah, it's been around that space for a few years. Now, if everybody starts using stamps and that's the only thing going on in the blockchain, this thing can grow quite fast.
And then what?
I think it's like tens of gigabytes a year or something.
It basically means it will require more of my computer's resources to run a node. My computer will get slower if I want to do other stuff. That's basically the problem here.
Yeah, pretty much.
Is there a benefit? So Mike in space, and again, I don't know to what extent he's trolling, but the sort of purported benefit is also that it's kept in UTXO. Is this an argument that you think, can you steelman this? Is there any?
Yeah, I think the argument then is that it's harder to prune. So if your goal is to put something in the blockchain and keep it there, well, even with ordinals, it's going to be in the blockchain. So in that sense, it's there. And the entire blockchain should always be available. Now, there have been talks about syncing a Bitcoin node and then not downloading all the witness, at least from the older blocks. So in that sense, there might be nodes in the future that will never have these ordinals on them. And that, from the ordinal point of view, is considered a good thing. It's like a way to not waste resources.
Wait, from whose point of view?
From the ordinals folks' point of view. They're trying not to waste resources beyond what they need.
Well, but they do want the data to exist on the blockchain, right?
Yeah, it exists on the blockchain, but nodes don't have to download that part of the blockchain, at least if they're pruning. So there's like a special case if you're running a node that's going to prune things and you use the assume valid block, then you can skip downloading all the witness data. Now, this is a couple of things we talked about many episodes ago, but
yeah, but I still want to. dig a little bit into this, because this does seem to be the main difference between stamps and inscriptions. I mean, the way people are talking about inscriptions is this idea that 10,000 years in the future, and there will be, you know, Mars colonies, and people, when people download the blockchain, they'll still find these original Digbot pics.
Yeah, so, but this is a tricky question, right? And it depends on where these things are. So you could say, well, the UTXO set is sort of the most durable thing because it's the database of who owns what coin. So to be in there sounds possibly as the most durable thing you can do to make sure that everybody running Bitcoin in the future will have your dick pic on their computer in RAM, like, ready.
Mm-hmm.
But, and then if you're going back from that, when you look at something like ordinals, because the data is pruned, every node that is, or sorry, because the data is only in the blocks, but not in the UTXO set.
Also, we're talking about inscriptions.
Yeah.
To be specific.
Yeah. So precise. When you're talking about inscriptions, the data is inside the blocks, but it is never inside the UTXO set. And so if you're pruning the blocks as a node, so if you're keeping only the most recent 1,000 blocks, eventually you throw these ordinals away, so they're not going to be on your disk anymore. And further than
that... Let me ask you a more specific question, which is more to the point. Is there a potential future where inscriptions that are included in the blockchain today are not available in the future while Bitcoin is still working and running just fine?
That depends very much on your definition of just fine and what you're willing to tolerate. So there is a possible future where you could say, hey, you know what? We're not going to sync from the Genesis block, or at least, you know, you could, if you wanted to, you could sync all the way from the Genesis block 50,000 years in the past and all the way through. But maybe most people have decided, you know what, we're only going to sync the last 100 years. And that could lead to a situation where one day, you know, all you have is the last 100 years and nobody has the actual blockchain all the way back to the 21st century.
Right, exactly. In that world,
you'd still have this thing in your UTXO set. Because that's not going to go away.
Now you're going to stamps.
Okay.
Even in that world, we would know that there's only 21 million coins, right?
Yes, you can see the total supply.
Yeah, the only thing we wouldn't know for sure is if any coins have been stolen over 100 years ago.
Exactly.
Okay, so that actually sounds to me like that's a feasible past. That's a feasible future.
Yeah, although it could still create lots of conspiracies, right? Because you might have this really rich family and you would say, well, we know that 5 generations ago you guys stole Bitcoin, but nobody can prove it anymore because you killed everybody who still had the blockchain. And so it could still lead to controversy, but it's a plausible future at least.
Right, yes. Okay, so that's a plausible future. Okay, now let's go to stamps. So is the claim that it's better to store in UTXO for this reason, for example, actually a good steel man?
Yeah, this would be the argument, and we'll get later to why this doesn't work either. But at least it's plausible that in this case, people still have to keep the list of who owns which coin. Who owns which coin has to be kept by nodes in some way, either in memory or on disk. Because you never know if it ever gets spent.
Yeah.
Especially with the way they're doing it now, because it is actually one of the keys is valid.
Right. Okay. So in this plausible future where people are only keeping track of the last 100 years, and other than that, Bitcoin doesn't change, I guess we should sort of add that. Mm-hmm. Then it sort of makes sense to use stamps if you want to make sure that people will still find your Digbot picture.
Yeah, but even in the shorter 10,000
term, years from now.
Even in the shorter term, there are proposals where if you want to prune your node anyway, so if you don't want to keep all the old blocks, you will, right now when you turn on this pruning feature, you will download the whole blockchain, you will verify the whole blockchain, but you will toss away the old blocks once you're done with them. And there's a second feature that we discussed many, many episodes ago called Assume Valid, not Assume UTXO. Assume Valid is a feature that says when you're starting up this new node, and all nodes do that now by default, we're not going to check any signatures before, I don't know, 6 months ago or a few months ago. With the, you know, with some security assumptions around that, you can turn that off. But if you do turn that on, which is the case by default, you're not validating the witness data for all the blocks. And so then the idea would be that if you're pruning anyway, it is completely pointless to download witness data, not verify it, and then delete it. You're literally downloading something, not looking at it, and then throwing it away. Well, you're looking at some aspects of it, but you're not looking at most of it. And so one concrete proposal that's already people are trying to implement is to just not download the witness data for all blocks. And so then you could say, well, but then your ordinals won't be downloaded by all new nodes. Only some lucky nodes will have the ordinals in it. Which is a good thing if you're trying not to waste people's resources, but it's a bad thing if you somehow want to be stored.
Your point being that it might not only... Like the stamps argument, if we're steelmanning, it doesn't only make sense 10,000 years into the future when people are only downloading the last 100 years. It might actually make sense in a couple of years in the future when people are not downloading witnesses that are older than 6 months.
Yes.
Right? That's the steelman.
Exactly. They will still be around because nobody's going to delete the blockchain, and there's very good reasons why you want to make sure that the blockchain stays in existence and is widely available. But that might be their worry.
All right, so that's the steel man for stamps. Now let's, it's not a straw man, I think. It's a legitimate...
We're going to melt.
It's also not a concern, but does this... I'm just want to question, does this steel man really hold up?
Well, this, I would describe this phenomena as U3XO-accelerationism. If we want to give it a name.
Right, I was thinking.
Really, this problem that we want to keep track of who owns which coins, this has been known to be a problem that does not have a limit. Because there could be an infinite number of coins, and every year, tens of gigabytes of new coins could be created that people have to keep track of. Even if it's on a disk at some point, if you have 200 gigabytes of things, you can't prune it. And it can grow forever. So something that cannot be pruned and can grow forever is bad, generally. And so there is a solution to that problem, which is called U3XO, which we did a whole episode on 2 years ago.
Yeah. What's the episode number?
I don't know, but just look for U3XO.
I'm pretty sure it's just called U3XO.
Yeah. So it's a U and then a tree, like in the thing with leaves, and then XO.
Right. So U3XO would be a way to essentially prune... The UTXO set, right?
That's right. And the short version of it is that instead of every node keeping track of which coin is where, the burden of evidence is sort of turned around. So you're telling, if you want to spend a coin, you need to prove that this coin exists. I'm not going to remember that this coin exists. And there's some mathematical magic there that means that I, as a node operator, only have to remember like a kilobyte worth of data, bunch of Merkle trees or some other mechanism. And then if you send me a transaction, including a piece of proof, then I can check that this transaction is valid and spending a coin that exists. So you're basically hiding the whole UTXO set inside a Merkle tree.
Yeah. So even if the argument that it's better to put it in the UTXO set is superior because it can't be pruned, even that is not really true because there are solutions to prune the UTXO set. Except they're not in Bitcoin yet.
No, and I think within the next couple of weeks, there's going to be a demo of this software, so people are working on it, but this would just be a demo. And of course, ultimately, something like this, in order to really get rid of the UTXO set, it would have to be a soft fork that is pretty dramatic. So this is not something that would happen in the next year or so, probably not even the next decade or so. Well, because there is a pretty serious downside to it.
It might also depend on how many people are going to use stamps. As you said, stamps might be sort of an acceleration
motivation
behind U2XO.
There's always a balance when you want to do a new piece of functionality between how desperately do you need it and how scary is it. And this is scarier than something like Taproot, I would say.
Hmm.
And we don't really need it at the moment. But, if the dynamics change, then... So the downside of this proposal, U3XO, is that it's going to make blocks bigger. So that creates a trade-off where you need more bandwidth. And that's a pretty big deal in some countries.
Right.
But so is storage, so...
Okay, well, we've done a whole episode on U3XO, so if people want to know more about that, you should probably just go back to that episode
but if we go to a world where you only download the last 100,000 or the last 100 years of blocks or even less, and you're not holding on to the UTXO set, that means that your Bitcoin node is always going to be the same size. The blockchain is always going to be the same size because it's only just the last 100 years, for example. So I don't know how many terabytes that is, but that's it. And the UTXO set is always going to be one, like a kilobyte. Right. And then the system can be like that forever. So that's kind of a nice potential future.
Okay, letting go of the future for 1 second.
But that would mean that these any of these things, ordinals would be gone. Or at least they would be, wouldn't be gone. They would just not be on your hard disk unless you want them to be. So if you want to reveal them, somebody can give you proof and they can show that indeed this picture exists on the blockchain in some way that you define existing, but it wouldn't actually be on your disk anymore.
One thing,
although you could say, like, if something is in a Merkle tree, is it really there? That's a nice philosophical question.
If a Merkle tree falls in the forest. Okay, letting go of the future for 1 second. One thing we haven't mentioned, I think, is just a difference in cost between stamps and inscriptions. And essentially, inscriptions are a lot cheaper, right?
Because
inscriptions use the SegWit discount, which we discussed in our inscriptions.
Yeah, they are cheaper in two ways, exactly. They use the SegWit discount, so that makes them a factor four cheaper. Well, in three ways, I guess. I think they're also cheaper because they use like the transaction itself more efficiently. Like, it's not because you're not adding this third multisig key for every output. So like a third of the data is being used to repeat the public key that's real when you make this counterparty thing. So if you have, for example, six outputs, then each of these outputs will have one real key in them. So that's one third of your data,
right,
which you are paying fees for. And the third way is that you're not dealing with the SigOps limit.
Yes, you want to get to why the block failed, but I want to make sure we're done with the whole stamps thing. And it's been a bit all over the place with the pros and the cons and the comparisons. But one thing we sort of mentioned, but it's worth repeating, is that a potential kind of benefit of stamps is that they can also be removed, spent. Right?
Yeah, that's using that one valid key.
Yeah, so if you use that one valid key to actually spend the funds that were in there, then the UTXO set disappears again. The stamp disappears from the UTXO set, right?
Yes, which is the same for the ordinals, for the inscriptions.
Is it? No, it's not.
Yeah, you can just burn them. You can send them to Opportune.
Yeah, now you're talking about ordinals. So,
well, the inscription is not even using the UTXO set in the first place.
I know. But so with stamps is using the UTXO set, but it can also be removed from the UTXO set.
Yeah.
If the coins are spent. Right? Mm. I think there was one more thing I wanted to say about this. Oh, yeah. So that's kind of, I don't know if it's funny or interesting or dumb or all of the above, but it also means that you can create a stamp and then I can sell the stamp to you. Well, I mean, as dumb as we can pretend that I sold a stamp to you by sending you a counterparty transaction. But then afterwards, since I have the private key that can remove the stamp from the UTXO set, I can still remove it.
I'm not sure whether that's true. It could be. It could be that you're transferring everything. Well, but then I guess then you would have to rebroadcast the whole picture. That would be really inefficient. So yeah, I'm guessing you can, as the original creator, remove it from the UTXO set. As the current owner.
As far as I understand, yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So that's, we both immediately thought of the Banksy painting, which would be the equivalent. So you sell it and then you destroy it.
Yeah.
Okay, I know you really, really want to get to the invalid block. First of all, Shors, give us your expert opinion. What should people use, inscriptions or stamps?
Neither.
Well, pick one though. You got to pick one. People are desperate to upload their dig bots onto the blockchain.
No, I can't see into the
protocols
mind.
Protocols should they use?
I can't see into the mind of why they would want to do this, so I can't make that choice for them. We've explained the differences. It does actually, before we get to the block, raise one other issue or one discussion that's been renewed now. That even happened with ordinals, with inscriptions. The discussion is we have a limit on up return, right, for 80 bytes.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, should we just get rid of that limit? Because, you know, or at least increase it to something really large for two reasons. One is that these ordinals are getting around that limit anyway, or these inscriptions are getting around the limit anyway. And if people do use Opportune, then at least they're paying four times as many fees per byte that they're using. And the other is that then they would maybe stop using these bare milkshakes.
But they wouldn't, though, because that's apparently the point for them. They want it in the UTXO set.
Yeah, and so for
that's
that,
the selling point.
Yeah, and then they would have to modify the philosophy of Counterparty itself, because as far as I know, Counterparty tries to like use the most efficient way to put stuff on the blockchain, and by making these pictures slightly bigger, it has to fall back to the inefficient way. But if we were to raise the upper-turn limit, then Counterparty could just always use upper-turn, and there would be no reason to use up-multisig unless you deliberately run an old version of Counterparty software or something contrived like that. But it sounds like, given the motivation, that they might actually do that.
I mean, that's the selling point, right? It seems like.
Okay, so...
Okay, you want to get to the invalid block, desperately. Before we get there, I'll say it, use inscriptions, don't use stamps, it's ridiculous, it's more expensive, it's annoying to fill the UTXO set with crap. Please, if you must upload your dickbot, use inscriptions.
So anyway... Source,
why was there an invalid block?
Well, yes, so on April Fool's Day of all times, F2Pool produced a block that was invalid with the message, bad SIGOPS. Count or something like that. And that means this SIGOPS limit was violated. And as we explained last week, there is this extra limit in the block, not just the size, but the...
First of all, how do we know there was an invalid block? If it's invalid, why do we know about it even?
Well, if your node sees it, it'll tell you it's invalid. And the reason your node saw it, there can be two reasons for that. One reason could be that, well, you happen to have been connected to the miner, they sent it to you, or you were connected to somebody evil, and they send it to you even though they knew it was valid. Or, and this is what happened at least in case of my own node, you received it through a compact block. And I don't think we've done an episode about compact blocks, so we can do that some other time. But the idea of a compact block is to send the block as fast as possible through the network, not like, wasting as little time as possible while not making it unsafe, basically. And so what you do is when you receive a compact block, you check the header, and if the header has enough work, then you will send on the message. So you send it first, and then you check the block. And that's why that block would have been spread.
Okay.
There's more to compact blocks, but that's the most important aspect of it here.
Okay, so that's why we know, or at least that's why you know. No, it was posted probably in message forums and stuff, right? People know about this block. I mean, I didn't, but...
Yeah, there's the other way you would find out about the block is you read about it, and some people have posted the full block, so you can download it and send it to your own node and see what your node thinks of it.
Okay, so there was an invalid block, and you mentioned the SIGOP limit was reached. Is that what you said?
Yeah, so as we explained last week, when you use raw multisig, what happens is that it counts as 20 SIGOPs. So there's this counter called the SIGOPS counter, and each raw multisig counts as 20 of these units. We'll just call them units.
Yep.
And, well, with SegWit, you know, that was multiplied by 4, but then the maximum was also multiplied by 4, so we can kind of ignore that. We can just say it counts as 20 points, whereas a normal single signature transaction counts as 1 point. So even if you're only using a 1-of-1 multisig, you're still using those 20 points. Right. So these counterparty transactions are using 20 points for each output. So not for each transaction, but for each output. And there's 20,000 points to a block. That's the limit. So you can have 1,000 of these things in there. Now, we looked at one example of these counterparty transactions, and we saw it was creating 6 outputs for like a tiny, tiny picture. And so that is 6 times 20 is 120 SIGOPS.
So that means there can be less than 200 in a block?
Exactly. Yep.
It's never a good idea to do math live, right? But I'm saying that's right, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Less than 200 per block.
Right. Yep. So, and that's what happened? So there were more, than 200
stamps? This is the tricky part. I've been trying today and yesterday to figure out exactly how many of these SIGOPS points were used, because Bitcoin Core won't tell you. The only thing Bitcoin Core will do is it'll count them internally, and when there's too many, it says too many, and it stops counting. So it doesn't give you the total, doesn't say where they are. Now, you can use other tools to try and figure that out, and I'm not super good at those tools. So anyway, I've been counting, I think the highest number I was able to get at was with the SegWit counting, which is 4 times the limit. I got 79,828 in total, which is less than 80,000, which means I'm counting something wrong.
Can you repeat that?
79,828 points.
Wait, wasn't the limit?
Well, with SegWit, the limit is 80,000. So, and then you have to multiply by 4 the punishment. But if I look only at those upper turn transactions, those bare multisig transactions, then I find how many? 890 bare multisig transactions. So that's not the number of assets, because you probably have to divide by 5 or 6, depending on how big they are.
Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty close to the limit, right? Because they count, in SegWit, they count as 20 times 4, basically. So you get 71,000 points just for all this counterparty stuff. I'm saying counterparty stuff, there might be somebody else using bare multisig, but I'm just going to assume it was only the counterparty people.
Right.
So you know, 71,000 out of 80,000 was already used for this counterparty stuff. And then, of course, there's other transactions out there that also count.
So in short, this block was invalid because people were stamping too much. That's what it sort of sounds like.
If a miner is configured correctly, it won't produce an invalid block. It will simply just not include all the pictures. It has to decide what to throw out. So ideally, when you create a block as a miner, you just want to look at the highest feeds and sort them from high to low. But unfortunately, when all these pictures are in there, you really need to make sure that you're taking into account that you don't go over this limit. And Bitcoin Core will do that for you if you let it construct a block. And some miners probably use Bitcoin Core to create the block, but other miners think they can do it more efficiently, and they might be correct about that. So, but then if you do it wrong, then you could produce an invalid block.
So usually, you just mentioned, usually when you're constructing a block, you're just filling the block as full as possible with as many fees as possible.
Yeah, and that itself is also a non-trivial problem, but at least it's like a one variable. But keep in mind that you can have transactions that are groups, like clusters of transactions.
Sure.
And so you can't arbitrarily remove things from a group because it has to be a chain, like it has to, you know, has to be complete. So the actual puzzle of finding the most economically efficient block is non-trivial.
Yes,
but it's made very, very non-trivial because of the SigOps limit.
Yeah, this sounds like there needs to be another limit being weighed in when calculating fees. So you might need... So while inscriptions actually gives you a discount, stamps might, if miners are configured correctly, be more expensive than usual Bitcoin transactions.
Exactly. If you can choose between two transactions with the exact same size and the exact same fee rate, you'd want to pick the one that does not have bare multisig in it.
Right.
But the question is, can you just translate that to say, well, it's the equivalent of so many sats per byte extra premium? I don't think it's that simple.
I mean,
and my guess is Bitcoin Core internally uses some like heuristic to make it expensive enough so it never goes over the limit. But that heuristic might not be the most economically efficient one. It might just be the safest one because nobody's using that feature, so it doesn't have to be efficient. Well, until now. So somebody might have thought, hey, I'm not getting the maximum revenue because of this Bitcoin Core thing is not giving me the perfect block. I'll just try it myself. And then they might have done that. You know, they might have started doing that just after the first hype around counterparty died out. So they didn't really take that into account. And then it went were perfectly fine for 4 years. And then, boom, it blew up.
Right. Yeah, what you're saying is this block was not mined with any sort of Bitcoin Core software.
No,
well, have been.
And another reason we know
to
that.
To some extent, right?
I don't know how miners produce their blocks, but the one observation that you can do is you can look at mempool.space and another website called miningpool.observer. Now, it turns out if you go to miningpool.observer, which is one site, what that site does is it actually uses Bitcoin Core to produce a template of a block. So it says, hey, Bitcoin Core, if there was a block right now, what would be in there? And it does that every 10 seconds. And so then it looks at the real block, but unfortunately, it didn't look at the invalid block. It looked at the valid block. And then you can see that the valid block looks almost identical to what was in Bitcoin Core. And so that suggests that the miner that produced the valid block was probably using Bitcoin Core because it came to almost the same result. And the difference was 3 transactions, and that could just be because they didn't see those 3.
Yeah. That makes sense.
And those were not counterparty transactions. Those were very small, normal transactions. Now, on the other hand, we have pool.space, which has its own way of calculating what would be ideal for a block. And it does not use Bitcoin Core's method of doing it. And so it also compares every 10 seconds or whatever what it expects in a block. And it shows you a really nice graphic nowadays, with pink being the color of blocks of transactions that are not included. And then you see lots of big transactions that were not included, and many of these were these counterparty transactions. So what that means is that whatever heuristic mempool.space is using would include these transactions, because they are probably paying a very good fee rate. And then it would see, hey, why is the miner not including them? Well, it doesn't know, but of course it's because of the SIGOPS limit.
Right.
And so probably the miner would have been using an algorithm that's closer to what mempool.space is doing. Not the same code necessarily, but something similar, because it makes sense from an economic point of view, but you're ignoring this limit. But ideally, you'd want to have a way to compare the invalid block to what these tools are doing to see what the miner is doing. So in that sense, this new protocol has given us interesting information. It's shown us that some miners use different ways to compose their blocks.
Right. Moral of the story.
And they have not commented yet on it. So
if you're mining blocks, use the SIGOPS limit, because retards are uploading dumb images in very inefficient ways on the blockchain.
Yeah, and I guess either you want to use the Bitcoin Core way of doing it, but like I said, it may not be the most economically efficient algorithm. I haven't studied it in enough detail. Or if you do roll your own, maybe just don't include bare multisig at all. Just, you know, don't. It's not enough. It's not worth for those few extra satoshis to risk making an invalid block. Or be if you do include them, make absolutely sure you don't go over the limit.
I mean, that's maybe what CoinNuts does, right? I think they don't include bare multisig at all. Luke Dash's.
Well, yeah, you can always, if you're a miner and you have a mempool, presumably, you can configure that mempool to reject whatever you don't like. But there are downsides to doing that. For example, if you rely on compact blocks yourself as a miner, that's going to slow down if your mempool is incomplete. Because compact blocks, which we talked about earlier, you're basically sending a header over to the next peer, or you're sending a hash over to the next peer, and a list of transactions that are included in it. And then you look at that list of transactions, which is like a summary, and any transactions you don't have, you're going to ask from your peer. So that means if the last block did include something you don't like, well, then you won't have those transactions, and you then have to call your peers to get those transactions. All the while, you're missing, you know, seconds of revenue, perhaps. Because it might, especially these big ones, could take you a few seconds to download.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's a very non-trivial thing. Like if you don't want to mine these things, there's a cost to that too. But if you do mine them, there's a cost as well if you make a mistake.
Yeah, makes sense.
Taproot gets rid of the SIGOPS limit.
Taproot gets rid of the SIGOPS.
Yeah. So
but we have Taproot.
Yeah. So Taproot transactions do not count towards this limit.
Ah, I see.
Which means if blocks were only Taproot, this whole problem wouldn't exist.
I see. But yeah, you can't make bare multisig Taproot transactions yours.
Correct.
Okay, I think that covered it all. We sort of explained what stamps are and how they compare to inscriptions and why they're much dumber and why the block was invalid.
And why it's very hard to count SIGOPS. Well, we didn't say why, but I can tell you it's hard to count SIGOPS.
I think it's time to close us off.
I think so too. So thank you for listening to Bitcoin
Explained.
My fellow plebs, come celebrate Bitcoin Winter in Miami at Bitcoin 2023. The largest Bitcoin conference in the world returns to Miami from Miami 18th to the 20th. Head on over to b.tc/conference to get your tickets today. Use promo code BMLIVE to get 10% off your tickets before prices go up. Plebs, if you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, then you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's a free and a paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts Dylan LeClaire, Dr. Jeff Ross, and Sam Rule break down what's going on in the market so you don't have to. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com.
As 2023 begins, the broke issue stares head-on into the looming realities of a broken economy, a more broke central bank, and considers how Bitcoiners can share their knowledge, their projects, and their mentalities to remain strong economic nodes throughout the winter. As a global Bitcoin news medium with a mission to accelerate hyper-Bitcoinization, Bitcoin Magazine is for all Bitcoiners, the curious, convicted, and the maximalists. Inside Bitcoin Magazine, you will find exclusive interviews and profiles with leading Bitcoiners, actionable insights on the state of the market, breaking news and cultural trends, and powerful photos and artwork from the best artists in the world. Each issue will be shipped safely in a secure box mailer to protect the integrity of each copy. Print magazines, not money. Buy Bitcoin Magazine.